Chapter 6. Vranov nad Toplo, March 1942. Don't look back, please, Livy. I beg you, don't look back, Sibby urges her sister. The girls step off the front path, out onto the street. In the doorway, their mother is sobbing in their grandfather's arms. Livy had glanced back as she pulled shut the front gate. Her whimper of pain at witnessing her mother's distress felt like a club to Sibby's heart. But she had to be strong for Livy, for their mother. Sibby straightens up, and transferring her small suitcase from one hand to the other, she grasps Livy around the waist, and the two sisters march on and away. Just keep walking. That's it. Keep step with me. You're doing well, Livy. We'll be back home before you know it. It is a bright spring afternoon. The air is crisp and clear, the sky a deep cerulean blue. Livy's dark brown curls glint in the sun, while Sibby's waves bounce and settle as she walks. They are aware of the neighbours lingering in their front gardens, watching, as the sisters and the other Jewish girls make their way towards the synagogue. Instinctively, maybe stubbornly, Livy and Sibby stare straight ahead. Sibby is not sure her words of comfort are having any effect on Livy. Her sister leans into her, trembling a little. Where are they going? What will be expected of them? But the question which plagues Sibby more than any other concerns Livy. Will she be allowed to stay with her sister? 15 years old, and small for her age, how would Livy cope on her own? Magda should be here with us, says Livy, cutting into her thoughts. Aren't we always meant to be together? Magda is safe. That's what's important now. You and I have each other. We'll do the work, come home, and then we'll be together. And our pact, Sibby, to never be apart. There's nothing we can do about that now. Sibby didn't mean her words to sound so strident. Livy is crying now. Promise me, Sibby, says Livy between sobs. Promise me we will come home, and that we'll be with Magda, Mama, and Grandfather again. My sweet kitten, I promise you that one day soon we'll walk back down this street and go home. I just don't know when. But I will protect you until my last breath, which will be a long time coming. Do you believe me, Livy? Of course I do. Livy's tears have abated for the moment. She squeezes Sibby's arm. You're Sibby. Nothing stops Sibby getting what she wants. The sisters exchange a watery smile. Sibby takes in the other young girls, carrying small suitcases just like theirs, walking in the same direction. She notes the weeping mothers dragged back inside their houses by distraught fathers. They are walking through a nightmare. Some of the girls are on their own, others with their sisters or cousins, but no one crosses the street to walk with their friends. For some reason, they know this journey must be made alone. Livy, do you know why there are no boys here? Sibby asks. Maybe they've already taken the boys. We would have heard if they had. Why only girls, though, Sibby? What good are girls for hard work? Sibby forces a laugh, anything to ease the tension. Maybe someone has realized we can do anything boys can do. Their orders had been clear: to report to the synagogue at 5 p.m. on Shabbat. They are greeted by the sight of Halinka guards standing either side of the doors to the education block next to the temple. The block houses a large classroom where the girls, since early childhood, have received religious instruction. Sibby, as ever, is in awe of the synagogue, the towering building where she and her family have prayed and been comforted by friends following the death of their father and grandmother. forever a place of safety and security amongst her own people, today the building offers no such comfort. The Nazis have ruined it. The Halinka guards have ruined it. The girls are herded inside the classroom, while the few parents who had chosen to ignore the order to stay away are screamed at, hit with batons, and told to go home. "Stay here," Sibby says to Livy, letting go of her sister and dropping her suitcase. Hurrying outside, Sibby grabs hold of a young girl who is clinging to her mother, refusing to be parted. A guard is striking the woman on the back, over and over, but she won't let go of her daughter. A small crowd watches this brutal spectacle in horrified silence. "I've got you. Come with me." Sibby's courage is more evident than her fear at this moment. The girl loses her grip on her mother as Sibby pulls her away. Crying, screaming, the girl reaches out for her mother again, who is now being dragged away by the guards.
"I've got her! I'll take care of her, Mrs. Goldstein!"
Sibby shouts as she chivvies the girl, Ruth, inside. More and more girls enter the room, their fear written large on tearful faces. The room is full of grief and desperation.
"Ruthie! Ruthie, over here!"
a voice calls. Sibby looks around to see Evie, her young neighbour, beckoning Ruthie Goldstein.
"That's your cousin, isn't it?" asks Sibby, and Ruthie nods.
"I'll be okay now,"
she tells Sibby with a watery smile.
"She's my family."
Sibby goes back to where she left Livy. "We should find a space by the wall if we're to be comfortable," she tells her, leading Livy away from the centre of the room. The sisters stay standing, waiting for instructions, watching as more and more girls are ushered into the room. Despite the crisp morning air, the room is stuffy and noisy as girls call to one another and sob. Once a room full of happy childhood memories, it is now a hostile space. As the daylight fades, two small bulbs in the ceiling are turned on to emit a dull yellow glow over the room. Suddenly, and without warning, the door is slammed shut and the girl's fear intensifies.
"I'm scared, Sibby. I want to go home,"
Livy cries.
"I know. Me too, but we can't. Let's just sit down for a bit."
Now, with their backs against the wall, Sibby places Livy's suitcase between her legs before doing the same with hers.
"You must look after your case at all costs, do you understand? Don't let it out of your sight."
"What will happen to us?"
Livy asks.
"I think we might be staying the night, so we should get comfortable."
Sibby places her arm around Livy's shoulders, drawing her head onto her chest, holding her tight.
"Are you hungry, Livy, my kitten?"
Livy is crying again, shaking her head.
"Just close your eyes and try to get some sleep."
"I couldn't possibly sleep."
From somewhere deep inside, Sibby recalls the words to the Czech lullaby she sung long ago to baby Livy. Softly she begins to sing. "My little angel.
Lie, my little angel, lie and sleep. Mama is rocking her baby. Lie, sleep, sweet little one. Mama is rocking her baby. Lie, my little angel, lie and sleep. Mama is rocking her baby. Lie, sleep, sweet little one. Mama is rocking her baby."
Sibby hugs Livy tight. Within a few minutes, she hears her breathing slow. Sibby sends all the love she feels for her little sister into the sleeping child.
"I won't let anyone hurt you,"
she whispers into her sweet-smelling curls. Leaning back against the wall,
Sibby watches as other girls struggle for a space to sit down, negotiating a back to lean against, a spot by the wall. Some of them open their suitcases and remove small tins, hunks of bread, cheese. They offer the food around. Sibby thinks about Khashara and wonders what everyone is up to at the camp. On Sunday, they will question where she is and why she hasn't come back. She tries not to think about mother and grandfather, sitting down to a meagre supper at home. Will they even be able to eat? Sibby wonders whether Magda is better. She wishes she was here, but maybe she's better off in the hospital. Comforted by this thought, Sibby closes her eyes and remembers happier days.
We'll look at your sleeping arrangements tomorrow, once we know how many of you are willing to stay and do the training to become part of Khashara. Meanwhile, find a space and try to get some sleep. I promise you will all get beds, mattresses, blankets and pillows tomorrow.
Where are all the boys? One of the girls calls out. Sibby notes her cheeky grin, her shining eyes.
In another part of the camp. And before you go looking, it's a long way from here.
I'm Sibby. What's your name? Sibby asks the cheeky girl.
They are lying side by side on the wooden floorboards, pulling their coats tight around their bodies to ward off the wind blowing through the large gaps in the walls.
Aliza, nice to meet you, Sibby. Where are you from?
Vranov.
You?
Bardeyov.
But not for much longer. I can't wait to get to Palestine.
I know what you mean. I can't believe I'm actually here, Sibby says, giggling nervously.
Do you think we will train with the boys?
Aliza asks no one in particular.
Is that the only reason you're here? To meet boys?
The girl lying beside them sits up.
No, I want to go to Palestine, Aliza tells her.
Well, I'm only here for the boys, a voice from the back of the room calls out.
Hands up those who are here because they want to go to Palestine, says Sibby, so that the whole room can hear her.
All the girls in the room sit up, and everyone raises their hands.
Now, hands up all those who are here because they want to meet boys, Sibby asks.
The girls all exchange glances, more giggles, and once again every hand is raised. Instead of sleeping, as instructed, the girls talk and joke, exchanging names, towns of origin, ambitions.
Sibby feels an intense sense of pride in her decision to be there amongst these strangers, united in their purpose. Her sacrifice to leave her family and follow her dream of becoming a pioneer in a new and promised land will be worth it. She will work hard to reach Palestine, and then she will send for her sisters, for Mama and Grandfather. In this small room, devoid of bedding, but replete with a sense of adventure, the camaraderie amongst the women underpins Sibby's fervent wish to begin Khashara as soon as possible. She is one of the girls who will have a bed tomorrow night. Aliza stands up.
Why do we think the boys are here? She yells.
In unison, the girls shout back.
To go to Palestine and to meet girls.
Sibby wakes with a start.
I want my mama. I want my mama.
A girl's plaintive wail echoes into the room. Livy stirs, softly moaning in her sleep. Sibby whispers soothing words and Livy settles once more. As the early spring sunshine sneaks through the high windows, the girls wake, stand and stretch. Again they ask of one another, "Where are we going? What will be asked of us?" There are no answers, and soon the room falls silent, the girls sinking back to the floor to wait. Some eat from the rations in their cases. At least the room feels less bleak in the sunshine and more reminiscent of the days of old.
Wake up, Livy. It's time to wake up.
Sibby gently nudges her sister, whose slumbering head rests in Sibby's lap. Sitting up, Livy looks dazed, staring around the room, confusion in her eyes.
Would you like something to eat, Livy?
Sibby prompts. I'm not hungry, says Livy, her eyes taking in the girls, some of whom are crying. You have to eat something. We don't know how long we'll be here. Sibby opens her suitcase, looking for the food buried under and around her clothes. She takes the cake her mother had made for Shabbat dinner. Unwrapping it from the achingly familiar tea towel, Sibby inhales the aroma of Mama's cooking. She breaks off a small piece and hands it to Livy.
I don't want any. You know I hate this cake, Livy complains, brushing Sibby's hand aside.
All the same, we need to eat it. It won't last, and we need to save the tins. Doesn't it mean anything to you that Mama made it with her own hands?
Sibby grins and holds out the cake to Livy once more. Begrudgingly, Livy takes it and begins to nibble, rolling her eyes at each morsel, pretend gagging as she swallows. Sibby forces her own portion down. Her mouth is dry and the cake tastes of ashes.
I'm thirsty. I need something to get rid of the taste.
Livy is beginning to whine, and Sibby suddenly feels exhausted. She would like to whine too.
You will have to wait. I'm sure we will be given something soon.
They don't hear the door open, but jump to their feet as a voice booms, Up on your feet! It's time to go! The Halinka guard slaps his baton into the palm of his hand. Snapping the suitcase shut, Sibby stands up fast, grabbing Livy's case as she rises.
Hold on to your case, Livy, she reminds her sister. You are not to let anyone take it from you, do you understand?
Livy nods, her eyes on the doors at the front of the room from which more guards are entering their space. The girls are corralled into two lines and led outside. They squint in the bright sunshine of a beautiful day. Sibby pushes Livy ahead of her, holding on to the back of her coat. They mustn't lose each other, whatever happens. One side of the street is lined with Halinka guards, and on the other side are the girls' families, desperately calling to their daughters, granddaughters and nieces. They have broken curfew to be there. Jews can no longer wander where they will at whatever hour they choose. They are risking beatings and imprisonment. But for many, the punishment will be worth it to see their beloved children. Sibby knows that her mother and grandfather will not be amongst the crowd. They have never once left the house on Shabbat. The Halinka begin to march the girls down the street, away from the synagogue and the grief.
Where are we going?
Whispers Livy.
This is the way to the station, Sibby says, pointing ahead. Maybe we're to catch a train.
As the plaintive cries of their families fade, new voices, angry, hate-filled voices, greet them as they make their passage through the town. Their former friends and neighbours are hurling rotten fruit and stale bread at their heads, yelling their joy that the Jews are finally leaving. Sibby and Livy are stunned by the taunts, the full-throated bile being dispensed from snarling mouths.
What has happened to these people? These are the very individuals their grandmother had attended during childbirth, the same ones who shopped in their mother's store or sought her wise counsel.
They pass Mrs. Vagova, the cobbler's wife. Sibby had taken their shoes to be repaired as and when they needed new soles or some stitching. Often Mrs. Vagova would not allow her husband to charge for his work, reminding him the girls had lost their father after he had been injured fighting for their country. Now she is part of this roaring crowd, her hair out of its tidy bun, hanging loose and deranged around her shoulders, while she tells Sibby, Livy, and all the other girls that she hates them, that she wishes they would die. Sibby pulls Livy close. She can't prevent her sister from seeing or hearing what's going on, but this is all she's got, a warm body, enveloping arms. Sibby raises her chin, unlike the girls around them who are crying and wailing. This hateful crowd won't get her tears.
Hi, Sibby. I didn't think you were selected to leave today.
Vizek, her childhood friend, turned Halinka traitor, is walking towards them.
It was simply the promise of a smart black uniform that turned Vizek into a monster. Sibby ignores him. "What's the matter with you?" he probes, his dull eyes looking her up and down. "Why aren't you crying like all the other weak Jews?" He walks with them, as if they're taking a pleasant stroll together in the sunshine. Sibby pulls Livy closer, and at the same time sidesteps so she's shoulder to shoulder with Vizek, turning to meet his eyes. "You will never have the privilege of seeing me cry, Vizek. And if I ever think about crying, I'll just remember your ugly face, and I'll laugh instead. And as for weak, I'm not the idiot who needs to hide behind the uniform of a thug," Sibby spits. An older guard joins Vizek. "Get them back into line," he orders him. "And then take this little boy back to his mama," Sibby hurls after him, as she and Livy move back into the throng of girls.
"Sibby, what are you doing?"
Livy's eyes are wide with fear. "Nothing at all, Livy. That felt really good." The train station looms into view. Sibby was right. She remembers the pleasant trip they'd made the previous year, to Umane to visit relatives. Now they are hustled through the station to the platform, the guards shouting and pushing the girls onto the waiting train. They shuffle on board, place their cases overhead and find seats. No one is crying anymore. Instead, they are quiet, each young woman contemplating the family she has left behind, and the unknowable future stretching out ahead of them. Slowly the train pulls away from the station. Livy rests her head on Sibby's shoulder. They gaze out of the window at the bright spring day, the familiar fields moving slowly past. Several times the train stops with no indication of where they are. Fields to the left and right, and the stunning, still snow-capped Tatra Mountains in the distance, bidding their citizens goodbye. The train conductor makes his way down the aisles, empty mugs hanging from the fingers of his left hand, while in the right he holds a jug of water. As he hands Sibby and Livy a mug each and proceeds to fill them to the halfway mark, he mouths a "sorry," giving them a sad smile. Sibby glares at him, but Livy says, "thank you," drinking down the water in single gulp and handing back her mug. The train eventually pulls into a station, with signs telling them that they have arrived in Poprad. The doors to the carriages are flung open. Halinka guards step inside each carriage and shout, "Out! Out!" On the platform, new Halinka guards are wielding long black whips, snapping them into the girls' faces as they disembark from the train.
"They won't hit us, will they, Sibby? We haven't done anything wrong, have we?"
Livy whispers. "Of course we haven't," Sibby tells her, hoping her voice doesn't betray her own fear. A few feet away from where they stand, waiting for the next set of instructions, a girl approaches one of the guards and opens her mouth to say something when the guard raises his whip and strikes her on the arm. Several girls react, yelling at the guard, dragging the injured girl away. Sibby grabs hold of Livy as more guards flood the platform, ordering hundreds of girls into long lines, ready to start marching once more. They haven't been walking for very long when they are stopped in front of an enormous wire and steel fence, on the other side of which Sibby spies a number of imposing dark buildings. As the girls enter what is obviously a military compound, they note the army insignias on the vehicles, the barracks lining either side of the solitary road running the length of the fenced-in enclosure. Sibby and Livy join a group of girls being herded towards a two-story barracks. Once inside, the door is slammed behind them. Slowly the girls sink to the floor, claiming a space to sit down, lie down, or curl up in despair.
"Do you think they will give us something to eat?" Livy wants to know.
"I don't think we can expect anything more than what we got last night," Sibby answers.
"But that was nothing."
"Yes, nothing. Let's wait a little longer before we go back into our cases." Sobbing and whispering, voices rumble around this room and the room above.
but there's nothing to be done. Sibby and Livy lie down, and using their jumpers for pillows, their coats for blankets, they eventually fall asleep, too tired to feel hunger, fear, or longing. The next morning, when there is still no word from the guards, the girls are subdued. Sibby believes being left alone in this room to imagine the worst is part of the Hlinka's plan. Terrified, hungry women will be far easier to manage. Livy grabs her suitcase and climbs onto it to peer through the window into the courtyard beyond. "What can you see?" Sibby asks as others gather around. Pushing up onto her toes, Livy squints through the murky glass. Letting go of the windowsill with one hand, she attempts to wipe away the dust with her sleeve. Losing her balance, her arm smashes through the glass before she tumbles to the floor, unleashing a shower of broken glass. Sibby quickly pulls her away from the scene as the other girls also move into the depths of the room, wanting no association with the broken window. "Are you all right? Are you hurt?" Sibby brushes fragments of glass from Livy's hair, her coat. "I'm fine," Livy answers quickly. "Well, let me look at you." Sibby begins examining Livy's face for stray shards, and then she takes Livy's hands. There is a long, bloody gash running down the middle of Livy's right palm. Blood drips onto the floor. Sibby lifts her skirt, grabbing the white linen petticoat underneath. Bending over, she sinks her teeth into the fabric, making a small tear, and then proceeds to rip off long strips of cloth with which she wraps Livy's wound. Almost immediately, blood begins to seep through the white cloth. In shock, Livy watches her sister wrap her injured hand. She feels no pain. The door is flung open, and three guards enter. Without a word, each of them grabs two girls by the arms and drags them outside. Everyone in the room watches in horror, girls clinging to one another, as the door is once more slammed shut. An hour or more passes before once again the door is opened and the girls are ordered outside. Those who pick up their suitcases have them snatched away as they cross the threshold. Sibby hears a guard telling one girl that her suitcase will be there when she returns. They never see them again. The girls are led into another building, a large space with a kitchen area at the back. They line up and find themselves in front of the six girls who had been taken earlier, and who now hand them a small tin plate, a small pile of overcooked cabbage, and a piece of bread the size of their fists. Maybe this was once a dining room, but there are no tables and chairs, so the girls sit on the floor, forcing the tasteless food into empty stomachs. On their return to the barracks, buckets of water, mops, and scrubbing brushes greet the girls. They are told that they are to scrub the room until it shines. They take turns washing and rewashing the floor, each girl working until they have all scrubbed at least once, watched over by guards. They spend the rest of the day sitting, standing, crying. Late in the afternoon, they are taken back to the dining room and fed a small piece of potato and a slice of bread each. Back in the barracks, one of the girls reminds them that it is Pesach, Passover. But how can they take part in the rituals demanded of them in here? The girl points at a blonde-haired teenager who is sitting alone. "Her father is our rabbi. She should know the order of prayer, the rituals." All eyes turn to the girl, who nods and clicks open her suitcase to remove the chagadah. Soon everyone is gathered around joining her in prayer. A heavy sadness settles on them. The next morning, once more without breakfast, the girls are marched out of the compound and back to the train station. Once again, whip-carrying Hlinka guards mark their journey. The train is waiting on the platform, engine fired up and ready to go. But the girls are ordered past the rows of carriages, towards cattle wagons at the back of the train. "Get on board!" the guards yell, over and over. But the girls don't move. Sibby feels like an animal caught in the headlights of a car. They can't mean they should climb into a vehicle meant for transporting cows, surely.
Sibby, what's happening?
Livy cries.
I don't know, but these wagons, they're for animals.
But the Hlinka guards are serious. The whips are extended and used to shepherd the girls into the wagons, despite the fact they are so high off the ground. The cursing, yelling and hitting continues, all attempts at decorum abandoned, and the girls scrabble to climb aboard, reaching out to then help those on the platform to clamber inside. Sibby pushes Livy up into the arms of a girl who lifts her into the wagon. The stink of cow manure mingles with the very real smell of their fear. The girls are packed inside, standing room only. Bolts are drawn across the heavy doors, and the only light comes from shards of sunlight pouring through the wooden slats of the walls. Practically everyone is crying now. Those nearest the walls are screaming, smashing their fists against the slats, demanding their freedom. Sibby and Livy have entered a waking nightmare. There is no respite from the close proximity of other bodies, from the wailing, the terrible thirst and gnawing hunger. The train stops many times, sometimes briefly, sometimes for lengthier periods, but the door stays closed. Sibby tears more and more strips from her petticoat to change Livy's bandages until only the waistband remains. Finally, the doors creak open. The sun has slipped below the horizon, but even this half-light makes them squint. Sibby's heart almost judders to a halt when she spies the uniforms of the Nazis. It's the SS. She has only ever seen them in Grandfather's newspaper, but the dark grey jackets, the swastika in the bright red strip on their sleeves, there is no mistaking it. They line the platform, facing the wagons, holding their rifles in one hand and the leads of large, barking dogs in the other. The girls start to jump down, and the dogs strain to snap and snarl at them. Two girls are bitten the moment they land.
Faster! Faster!
The Germans scream, striking those they deem too slow with the butts of their rifles. Sibby and Livy move fast, leaping out of the wagon and standing to one side. They have arrived at what is obviously another compound. There are floodlights illuminating buildings, whole streets beyond the gates. They look at the sign above the wire fencing and read, Arbeit macht frei. Sibby knows enough German to decipher the meaning. Work sets you free. But then Sibby and Livy become transfixed by the shaven-headed, hollow-cheeked men who now swarm the train. In blue and white striped shirts and trousers, they move like rats fleeing a sinking ship as they clamber into the wagons and begin to throw the girls' suitcases onto the platform. Sibby and Livy watch one man pick up an empty sardine tin, Livy almost retching as he runs a finger around the inside, sucking on it, before holding the tin to his lips to drain the last of the oil. He looks up and notices the sisters watching him, but he carries on licking the tin, unabashed. The line of girls begins to move towards the gates.
"Listen to me, Livy," Sibby whispers urgently. "We will eat stones, nails, and whatever we can get our hands on. But we must survive this place. Do you understand?"
Speechless, traumatized, Livy can only nod. Yes. Part 2. The Gates of Hell. Chapter 7. Auschwitz, April 1942.
"Just keep walking, Livy. Stay in line," Sibby murmurs to her sister.
Once they are through the gates, the girls are led down a tree-lined street, the first flush of spring leaves waving in the cool breeze. Heat emanates from the harsh overhead lighting,
and Sibby is ironically reminded of a warm summer evening. They pass a grey concrete building, meeting the blank stares of young men and women who gaze back at them, expressionless from the windows. Sibby shivers. They could be yeshiva boys, the shaven-headed youth who studied the Torah. But she can't allow herself to think about home, about her friends. She must stay alert. Red brick barracks line both sides of several of the streets the girls pass through. Tall trees and pretty flowers in neat garden beds adorn the earthy plots in front of each building, giving the illusion of a welcoming home. Finally, the girls are led into a red brick, two-story building, where they find themselves face to face with its other occupants. It is a vast room, with high ceilings, but as large as it is still a tight fit for the hundreds of inhabitants inside. At least 1,000, thinks Sibby. The loose straw on the floor reminds her of a stable or barn, somewhere animals would sleep, not girls. The smell of manure adds to the impression that this room is for livestock. "They've put us in with boys," Sibby whispers, incredulous. But she can see that there are girls here too. Will the sisters end up like them? Wide-eyed and skinny, blank-eyed and desperate. The boys are in uniform. Sibby thinks it is Russian soldiers' uniform. Worn khaki trousers and button-down shirts, a yellow-bordered red star with the hammer and sickle. Sibby thinks they are looking at the girls with pity, probably because they know only too well what awaits them, or maybe they just don't want to share this confined space with them.
I think they're girls, Sibby.
Livy is unable to tear her eyes away from the emaciated figures who are still staring at them, in silence. Welcome to Auschwitz. A boy steps forward. You're in Poland now, in case they haven't told you. This is where we live. He waves a hand around the room, at sacks of straw scattered on the ground. Surely they can't be expected to bed down on these things, Sibby thinks.
What happens now?
A scared voice calls out. You sleep with the fleas, another answers.
But we haven't eaten,
the first cries, scared, tired. You're too late. You'll eat tomorrow. I warn you, you will also have your heads shaved like us. They shave all of your hair. And you will be put in a uniform like this, and then to work. Never resist. If you do, you will be punished. But so might we. The figure lowers his voice to a whisper. Sibby notes his eyes, pretty eyes in a thin boy's face. Livy is right. These boys are girls. The SS are everywhere, she says conspiratorially. But it's the capos who look after us we have to be wary of. Sometimes they're worse than SS. They're prisoners, just like us. But you must never trust them. They have chosen their side. Prisoners? The word startles Sibby. They are in a prison, and they will remain here until the Germans decide they can leave. Attempting to hide her fear, Sibby springs into action, claiming a lumpy mattress in the middle of the dark room. Come on. She takes Livy's hand and gently pulls her onto the bed. They lie down fully clothed, and in their coats, the straw crackling beneath their bodies, poking through rough hessian to scratch at their hands and heads. Sibby wishes they'd been allowed to keep their suitcases. Perhaps they'll be reunited with them tomorrow. One by one, the girls find beds and settle down, but there are not nearly enough, and 2, 3, 4 girls have to squeeze together, like sardines. Livy is crying, softly at first, but then she is sobbing. Sibby folds her arms around her sister and wipes away her tears with her sleeve. It's all right, Livy. You're hungry. We're both hungry. Tomorrow we'll eat, and it will be daylight and we'll feel better. Please stop crying. I'm right here with you. But Livy's tears are contagious, and soon the room is full of sniffing and gasping sobs. Girls stumble to their feet, tripping over each other as they head for the door. Voices call out to them to stop, come back.
"You'll get us all into trouble,"
a voice yells, very obviously now a girl's. "Go back to bed. It's worse out there than it is in here," shouts another. Livy's sobs slowly subside, and the room falls silent, until a cry of, "Something bit me!" and the reply, "It's just fleas. You'll get used to it." It is still dark when the girls are woken at 4 a.m. by the capos shouting at them to get moving. It is bitterly cold. Sibby and Livy slept fitfully, and now they are chilled, hungry and thirsty. Rubbing sleep from their eyes, they follow the inmates who have learned the rhythm of the morning ritual, lining up to use the makeshift bathroom of long troughs with dripping taps and open toilets. Sibby and Livy hold on to each other as they begin to file out of the room, but then Sibby lets out a cry and stumbles, falling to her knees.
"Sibby? Sibby, what's wrong?"
Livy says. Sibby rips off her shoes and socks to reveal feet alive with jumping fleas. Sibby holds the socks she had just removed in one hand and stares, paralysed at her feet. Around them, the girls climb over the straw sacks to get outside.
"Sibby, you're scaring me. We need to keep moving,"
Livy cries, shaking her sister's arm. Sibby looks at the socks and flings them away.
"It's okay. It's okay. We just need to wash your feet. I'll help. Come on."
But Sibby pulls away from Livy. This is her problem, and she must be strong for her sister. A young, shaven-headed girl pushes her way back through the crowd and grabs Sibby's discarded socks. "She'll need them," she tells Livy. "I shook out all the fleas." Livy is stunned by the girl's tone. Robotic, utterly devoid of emotion, but it is an act of kindness all the same. Livy takes the socks with a nod and shows them to Sibby.
"The fleas are gone. Please put them back on."
Sibby says nothing but doesn't resist as Livy pulls the socks onto her feet and then buckles her shoes. Sibby and Livy join the others trudging out of the building. Outside, they are separated from the old-timers and march to another building. In daylight, the streets and buildings don't look nearly as inviting. SS officers now line the pavements, rifles strung across their backs, handguns holstered on their hips. Prisoners spill out from buildings like the one Sibby and Livy have just spent the night in. They pass a group of men shuffling along beside them, a glance here and there, but no one makes eye contact. Eventually, the girls are ordered into a windowless room where they are instructed to undress. Sibby is grateful for the moment that they haven't been warned of what's to come, grateful that Livy has been spared, even for a few hours, the reality behind the blank stares of the hairless inmates. When some resist, their male and female guards think nothing of slapping them. Sibby and Livy and every other girl try to hide their nudity with hands and arms. The sound of men's laughter fills their ears as they shout obscenities at the naked girls.
"Your jewellery! Don't forget those pretty diamonds you have in your ears, girls. We want it all,"
their capo calls out, laughing. She is a tall woman with short, curly black hair and a single missing incisor. Sibby reaches a hand to one ear, and then the other. The small gold earrings with their tiny red stones had been fixed to her lobes on the day she was born by her grandmother, who had just delivered her. This would be the first time they had ever been removed. Sibby struggles to find the clasp holding them in place. She watches with growing horror as the capo rips earrings at random from girls' ears. Blood pours from split lobes as hysterical crying fills the room. She hopes Livy, wherever she is in this hellish room, has managed to remove hers. As she pulls them free, she finds the capo is standing in front of her,
hand outstretched to take the precious tokens of a grandmother's love. She thinks briefly of Magda, and thanks God her sister is many miles away. One by one, the girls are called into the centre of the room to be inspected by the Schutzstaffel SS guards, who continue to leer at the young female bodies paraded before them. Sibby remembers her grandfather telling her again and again, "Humour will save you. Laugh, and if you can't laugh, put a smile on your face." Raising her head to her examiner's, she puts a brave smile on her lips. She feels the flutter of 100 butterflies in her stomach. When she is called, she slowly makes her way forward to stand in front of a man dressed in striped trousers and shirt. He is the barber. He snips off lengths of her chestnut hair, and she watches the waves fall onto the growing mound at his feet. He flicks on a crude shaving machine and runs it over her head, reducing her once proud head of hair to stubble. Not finished, and to her shame, he drops to a knee. Spreading her legs, he directs the machine to her crotch, where he removes her pubic hair. She tries not to think of little Livy enduring the same humiliation. Without meeting her eyes, he nods for her to move on. They are then herded into another room. "Into the sauna with you all," another capo shouts. This room features large iron tanks filled with dirty water. Puddles of loose hair float on the surfaces of them all. Sibby climbs into the nearest one. This is not like any sauna she has heard of. Sibby's mind begins to drift away from this place, back to her home, to Magda and grandfather and everything she holds dear. If she can hold them in her mind, maybe it won't be so bad here. "The water is dirtier than we are," says a girl clambering out of the bath. "And colder." The freezing water snaps Sibby out of her trance. Her body has grown numb from the cold, as numb as her head and heart. Having climbed out and dripping with water, Sibby takes the clothes thrust at her. Dressed in the same Russian prisoner-of-war uniform as the older inmates, Sibby finds the harsh fabric of the khaki shirt irritating to her tender skin. The matching breeches threaten to fall down with every step. The rough clothes cling to her damp body, providing no warmth. The capo thrusts a piece of paper into her hands. She reads the digits scrawled onto it. 4560. Back in line once more with the other washed and shaved inmates, Sibby doesn't resist when she's called forward. Another man in blue and white stripes sits at a desk at the front of the room in which her hair was just shorn. He holds out his hand for the scrap of paper and tells her to sit down. The numbers, which stand in bold black letters against the grubby white, are etched into the skin of her arm. The pain is intense, shocking, but Sibby shows no reaction. She won't give this man her agony. Outside once more, Sibby joins hundreds of girls who, like her, are desperately searching for a familiar face. But no one looks familiar anymore. In identical clothes and shorn heads, there is nothing left to distinguish them. And then Sibby hears her name. She doesn't move as Livy runs to her, embracing her before pulling away and staring at her oldest sister. She runs her hand over Sibby's naked head. "What have they done to you? Sibby, you've got no hair." Looking at her sister's own naked head, Sibby doesn't reply. Livy is clutching her arm and wincing, tears of pain streaking pink cheeks. The pain of Sibby's tattoo is equally intense. She can feel the blood running into the creases of her elbow and wonders about infection. Putting her arm around Livy's shoulders, she steers her sister back to the building with the flea-infested mattresses. It is not until the sisters sit cuddled together that they look at their arms. "Your number is only one ahead of mine," Livy says. She wipes away the dried blood so Sibby can see the butchered number, 4559. When all the girls from Vranov have returned to their room,
their capo enters, accompanied by four emaciated men struggling to carry two cauldrons, a crate of small metal mugs, and another containing bread.
"Form two lines and come and get your food. You haven't done anything today, so you will only have half a cup of soup and one piece of bread. Anyone who pushes or complains will get nothing," the capo roars.
Taking their mugs and bread back to their mattress, the girls compare the contents of their soup.
"I have a piece of potato," Sibby says. "Do you?"
Livy stirs the weak brown liquid, shaking her head. Sibby pulls the potato out of her mug and takes a small bite. She plops the rest into Livy's mug. They spend the remaining time before lights out picking the fleas from each other's necks and ears. The old-timers return after dark. On their way to bed, they smile at the new girls and shake their heads in sympathy. Another 4 a.m. wake-up call.
"Rouse! Rouse!"
is screamed into the room, accompanied by the hammering of a baton on the walls. After a visit to the bathroom to wash away as many fleas and bedbugs as they can, Sibby and Livy receive their first breakfast in Auschwitz, a ration of bread the size of their palms, and a drink of lukewarm liquid they were told was coffee, but which bears no resemblance to any coffee they have tasted before.
"Soup and bread for dinner? Coffee and bread for breakfast," Livy mutters, forcing the coffee down her throat. "Remember what I said when we arrived. We will eat stones and nails, whatever we are given," Sibby replies.
"We should have kept the linden tea," Livy tells Sibby,
as if they had had a choice in the matter, as if they should have asked the guards to wait a moment until they had removed the precious leaves from their suitcases, before leaving them behind in the cattle wagon. Outside, a flurry of snow attempts to carpet the road, on which the girls now stand in rows of five. Livy and Sibby shiver, their teeth chattering. Sibby reaches for Livy's hand in an attempt to comfort her. She feels the soft touch of fabric and carefully pries apart Livy's fingers.
"How have you got this, Livy?" she whispers.
"Got what?"
Livy is holding a small pouch containing a sacred coin their mother had sewn into both girls' vests on the night of their departure.
"Where did this come from?"
Livy asks, oblivious to the fact it is in her hand.
"You tell me. How have you held on to it?"
I don't know."
Livy doesn't take her eyes off the coin.
"I didn't know I had it."
"Listen to me."
Sibby's voice is harsh and Livy startles.
"When we start moving, you have to drop it. Just let it go. We can't be caught with it."
"But it's from Mother. She gave it to us to keep us safe. The rabbi blessed it."
"This coin will not keep us safe. It will only get us into trouble. Will you do as I say?"
Sibby insists. Livy hangs her head and nods.
"Now, hold my hand, and when I let go, that's when you drop it."
For 2 hours, the girls stand in line as their numbers are called out. Sibby realizes that the numbers are the ones etched into their swollen arms. She pulls up her sleeve to memorize hers and instructs Livy to do the same. This is their identity now. Finally, their numbers are called. Once they have been assigned to their work details, Sibby and Livy march out of the gates, past the station, towards the town of Oswiecim. Outside the camp, empty fields surround them. In the distance, smoke billows from small farmhouses, and unseen horses neigh their presence. The SS stride up and down the rows. Those with dogs encourage them to bark and snap at the girls. Sibby slows down until the girls behind catch them up. Glancing around to make sure none of the guards are nearby, Sibby gently lets go of Livy's hand. She hears the soft thud of the pouch as it hits the muddy slurry on the ground. She takes hold of Livy's hand once more, squeezing gently, to communicate the message that they have done the right thing.
they enter a street of houses without roofs, some without walls. Mounds of rubble line the empty road. The old-timers move towards the brick ruins. Others clamber up onto the rooftops and begin to throw down bricks and tiles. Those on the ground weave and duck to avoid the falling missiles, not always succeeding.
You two!
Sibby looks around to see their capos staring at her and her sister.
Come here,
she instructs, and the girls hasten towards her.
See that?
She is pointing to a four-wheel cart 100 meters away. There are a couple of girls strapped to the front of the wagon in a harness, dragging it along, as though they are horses, Livy thinks.
They will show you what to do.
The girls hurry away to once again come face to face with the blank eyes of prisoners who have been here far longer than they have.
You're on the back, one girl says.
Livy and Sibby move to the back of the cart and await further instruction. The girls at the front begin pulling the cart towards a newly demolished house, where bricks are piled in long rows near its foundations. Several girls stand by, waiting. Livy and Sibby start pushing. When they reach the rubble, the girls start to load the bricks into the cart.
Don't just stand there. Help them.
Nudging Livy into action, Sibby starts heaving the bricks into the cart, just as the capo walks up to them. Livy throws in a brick, where it strikes another, chipping off a corner.
Break one more and there will be consequences,
the capo snaps. Sibby thinks of Magda and feels a wave of relief riding the length of her spine. She has been spared this torture. She wishes Livy weren't here. She looks and seems so much younger than all the other girls. She is brave, but she is still so little. How will she even handle this work?
Chapter 8. Vranov nad Toplo, April 1942. Chaya is seated by the window, in the very same position Livy occupied only days earlier.
We will hear her when she gets home, Chaya. Please, come away from the window.
Yitzhak lays a gentle hand on his daughter's shoulder and feels the rigid muscles tense beneath her skin. Chaya doesn't drop the curtain. She will not miss Magda's arrival.
Father,
she says, her eyes trained on the street.
I don't know how we'll tell her about the girls.
Yitzhak sighs. He has been worrying about the very same thing.
I will make some linden tea, he says in response, and Chaya nods.
Chaya presses her face to the window and lets her tears slide down the glass as she mumbles prayers, clinging to her faith, needing to believe these powerful words will reach Sibby and Livy, no matter how far away they are, that somehow they will hear them and know she is yearning for their safe return. Turning to receive the steaming china cup from Yitzhak, Chaya misses the moment Dr. Keasley pulls up outside the house. Magda is out of the car before he even comes to a full stop, racing up the path. When Magda bursts through the door, Yitzhak quickly takes Chaya's mug before she drops it. He steps aside to allow mother and daughter to collide in an embrace. Dr. Keasley appears in the doorway, placing the small bag containing Magda's belongings on the floor. Yitzhak and the doctor grasp hands. There is nothing to say as Dr. Keasley glances around the room, sensing that Sibby and Livy are no longer there.
And Magda?
Yitzhak finally says. She has recovered.
She is healthy and well.
The doctor's mouth twitches in a half smile, but it doesn't reach his eyes.
Chaya,
says Yitzhak, turning towards his daughter and granddaughter, still locked together.
It's time to tell Magda.
Magda pulls out of her mother's embrace.
Tell me what? And where are Sibby and Livy?
Come and sit down, my darling,
Chaya says, her voice full of tears.
I don't want to sit down.
Magda looks at her grandfather. Do you know where they are? When Yitzhak doesn't reply, Dr. Keasley clears his throat.
I must leave now.
but if you feel unwell or your fever returns, I'll come back immediately.
Yitzhak takes Dr. Keasley's hand once more and thanks him. He watches the doctor walk to his car before shutting the front door and turning to meet the fearful eyes of both Chaya and Magda.
Please, sit down, Magda. It will be easier.
The women take the sofa, and Yitzhak positions himself on the only other comfortable chair in the room. Magda squeezes Chaya's hand tight, and Chaya welcomes the pain.
Your sisters have gone to work for the Germans, Magda. We don't know where they are, but they weren't alone. Many of our girls were taken that day.
Taken to work for the Germans? Magda is aghast. Didn't Dr. Keasley tell her that her sisters were safe? Didn't he promise her that Livy was too young and that Sibby was away? It can't be, she says.
I wish it wasn't true, says her grandfather.
But when?
2 days ago. They all left 2 days ago.
On Shabbat?
Magda is slowly processing the fact that her sisters are not in the house, that Sibby is not at the Hashara, and that Livy isn't in the garden.
Yitzhak nods. Why would they do that? Why would they go off to work for the Germans?
They had no choice, my precious child. The Halinka guards had Livy's name on a list, and Sibby went with her to look after her.
For how long?
We don't know, says Yitzhak, sighing. Hopefully, not for too long. There is talk they are going to work on German farms. They may be there all summer.
Magda turns to her mother. Mama, why did you let them go?
Chaya begins weeping then, burying her face in her hands. Magda puts an arm around her shoulders, drawing her closer. Your mother couldn't stop them taking the girls, Magda. No one could stop them.
Yitzhak's voice breaks, and he retrieves his large handkerchief from a pocket to swipe away his tears. Suddenly, Magda releases her mother and gets to her feet. We need to find out where they are so I can join them, Magda pronounces.
Chaya gasps. We promised your sisters we would keep you safe. Here, at home.
Magda looks at her mother, defiance lighting up her eyes, a snarl on her lips.
We made our promise, too. Don't you remember, Mama?
She turns to Yitzhak. Have you both forgotten our pact to stay together?
Stay where? Says Yitzhak. We have no idea where they are.
Uncle Ivan could help us. He's still here in Vranov, isn't he?
Magda is flushed, in shock but determined.
Chaya nods slowly. Of course he is. I want to see my uncle now, insists Magda. He knows people. He has contacts. He can help us.
Perhaps he has heard something useful, she reasons.
She is staring at the back door, which leads to the house on the other side of the lane, where her uncle and aunt live with their three small children.
We've spoken to Ivan, and he has promised he will do all he can to keep us safe and in our home.
That is all he can do, Yitzhak says firmly. He runs the handkerchief over his face once more. Slowly, reluctantly, dazed by the terrible news, Magda collapses back onto the sofa and Chaya wraps her in her arms, trying to be the parent every desperate child needs.